So on the 19th of August, Tales from Rat City was invited to participate in the online event Folkopalooza, where folklore podcasters from around the world came together to discuss their work, the research, and their favourite pieces of dark folklore. And it was an immensely fun night. Well, in my case, it was an immensely fun, very, very early hours of the morning, about 5 a.m., given we were working with American and British podcasters, as well as ourselves from Australia. And the night took the form of a competition where each podcaster was asked to present their favourite example of folklore, and then we discussed and voted on the stories. I, David Waldron, represented Tales from Rat City and presented our own local ghost story, The Ghost of Harton Hills. So part one of this session is the stories, and part two, the debate.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to whichever podcast you are listening to, because in the room with me at the moment, not literally, but on my screen, for those of you of a certain age, it's like the most folkloric episode of Celebrity Squares I think I've ever watched. In the room with me are people from various other folklore-based podcasts that you might have enjoyed. And today we are going to have a big debate. You'll notice I used the word big and not any other word to describe the size of this debate. We're going to have a large debate about who has the best piece of folklore to sell to the rest of us as a story. At the end, we will all vote on who has the best folkloric tale. But first, let's meet who is in this mass recording of folklore podcasts. Starting top left on my screen with Paul from Tales of Whitlaw. Paul, tell us a little bit about your podcast.
Well, probably, I would say, unlike most people, I take it very, very seriously. I work very hard on my podcast. I make sure I edit it down. Now, I wing everything. Mine's absolutely terrible. Don't bother listening to me. I make everything up as well. The end.
Perfect. Okay, I think that's a good recommendation that you've given yourself there. I don't think anybody's going to better that one. Next up, Rick from Lore and Legend. Tell us about you.
Hi there, I'm Rick. Together with my co-host and fellow storyteller, Sebastian O'Dell, we do Lore and Legend, Tales from Our Epic Past. And that is a mix of sort of traditional style storytelling, but also with a bit of audio illustration and soundscapes and that kind of thing. So yeah, we've done two series so far. We've got a series on British folklore, and our second series, which is about the Greek mythology of dreams, is just starting at the moment. So the first full episode is out on the 26th of this month. So that's us.
Awesome. Thank you, Rick. Next is Holly from History and Folklore Podcast. Hi, Holly. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Hi. I'm quite a new podcast, and I basically look at medieval history and sometimes early modern history, but mostly medieval through Europe, and folklore, traditional tales, and try and see what that tells us about how people looked at nature in the past. Which sounds actually quite boring when I put it like that. So it's just me basically rambling on for 15 minutes about history and folklore and nature tales, really.
Thank you very much. Graham from Tales of the British Isles. What do you cover?
Okay, so I'm Graham, and it's fairly self-explanatory in the name there, but I make the Tales of the British Isles podcast, which is basically old folk tales and legends from Britain and Ireland told in a sort of modern way, I suppose. And after each episode, I'll give a brief and decidedly non-expert rundown of some of the history of the story, which I like to go into a bit. We've done quite 26 episodes now. I am covering things from Irish mythology, the Mabinogion from Welsh mythology, and also some odd little tales, like the tale of Albina, a murderous princess who founded Britain. So that's pretty much it, and I always rely on a script, so this is pretty difficult for me to be doing, so I'm looking forward to that.
Thanks, Graham. Moving across to the other side of the world, next up is Mr. David Waldron from Tales from Rat City.
Hi all. My podcast is on dark stories from the goldfields of Victoria. Perhaps a little bit ironic, we have this sort of Victorian theme. and I particularly love looking at these stories using original dialogue and having voice actors to read the letters, diary entries, newspaper articles from the period as we look at these stories developing out of the darker and more traumatic sides of the goldfields of Australia in the 1850s, 60s and 70s.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Dave. Fabulous folklore. Miss Icy Sedgwick, tell us about you.
Well, hello there. I do fabulous folklore, and it is essentially get your fix of fabulous folklore in. It should be 15 minutes or less, but I do like to go on a bit, so now it's sort of pushing 20 minutes, so I hope people will forgive me the extra five. I generally look at, a bit of everything. Plant folklore, ideally, bit of mythology, generally Northern European, as that's clearly where I'm from, if the accent didn't give it away. And yeah, if I can get a bit of urban legends on there, then I will. And that's my sneaky little hint for what's coming up in this this big debate that we're going to be having.
20 minutes is absolutely good. Some of us have podcasts that go on for hours and hours. James, one half of Lawmen, tell us about your podcast.
Well, so me and Alistair do it together.
Yeah, you need me to back you up, that James. You're feeling a bit intimidated. I'll jump
massively.
In.
Yeah. Yes, please do.
I'm here. Relax. It's as normal. Just pretend everybody else isn't there.
Okay. Whoa. I met a whole bunch of weird bunch of people today. No.
Tell me about it.
Hello, everyone. I'm James from the Lawman podcast. I co-host that along with Alistair, who's
hello.
Also here. And our podcast is, we look at the more obscure legends and eccentric bits of folklore that you know because it happened in the village that you grew up in, kind of thing, and probably no one else knows about it. That's what we want to hear about.
Yeah, like the local legends that haven't had the Hollywood treatment. So I always say, like, it's like Loch Ness and Robin Hood. It's not that. It's like, well, Icy will know the Lambton Worm, but it's stories that are really, really famous in one area, but don't really travel.
Like the ghost duck. Although like the ghost duck did travel, even though it had no head. But
that's what made it so dangerous, its ability to travel, yes.
Yeah. So that's
superb. Thank you both very much. Next up, let's have House of Legends. Tell us about you, Daniel.
Hello. So I run House of Legends podcast. It's been going for just over a year now. It was weekly, but that got too much. So now it's fortnightly. And I come from a background of oral storytelling. I've been an oral storyteller for about 10 years, and I'm really passionate about that. So that's the focus of the podcast. It's either myself or a guest oral storyteller telling a story as we would to an audience. So without a script, just improvising on the story we know and love. And more recently, I've been doing more longer interviews with other storytellers and getting into why they love stories, how they became a storyteller, so on. And I also sometimes do cheeky readings from my books because I'm not averse to a bit of self-promo.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Over the pond to the States, Bone and Sickle and Mr. Al Ridenour. Good evening to you.
Bone and Sickle is partly folklore, but we also try to drag in pop culture stuff, and usually horror movies. I always describe my show as the intersection of the horror genre and folklore, and that horror can include literature, going back to the Gothic and Romanticism, and can go up all the way up to campy movies from the 70s and beyond. So we look at folklore from all over the world. It's all presented from another world I live in, where it's sort of in the neighborhood between Charles Adams and Edward Gorey. So I have a library there, and I have an assistant there who helps me and is very preoccupied with bees. So we've been doing a bit of storytelling. She presents all the direct quotes from our historical sources, primary sources. And I provide everything that connects those. I always like to go have the primary sources. They're more dramatic than we know how to be now, I think. So we put a lot of emphasis on that. Lots of production on it too, music and sound effects, to kind of get in that region between a lecture and a radio play.
Indeed. Lovely. Thank you very much, Al. Two to go. Celtic myths and legends. Sian.
Completely forgot to mute myself. Hello. I probably can one-up Paul because I wing everything. I'm wildly inconsistent and I'm incredibly unproductive. So that's sort of my show in a nutshell. I cover all six Celtic nations, but it kind of veers between folklore and, you know, mythology and things like that. But yeah, I'm up to 19 episodes in almost 3 years. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Sian. And finally, last up is the mysterious anonymous lady who does not announce her name from the Fairy Folk podcast. Good evening to you.
Hello. So the Fairy Folk retells local myths and legends from around the UK. As well as retelling the legends themselves, I also like to talk a little bit about the places that they're set and how you can visit them too. So it's sort of an audio tour, if you like. The podcast doesn't just cover fairies, as the name might suggest. We've looked at dragons, mermaids, and many other folk tales as well. And I also usually like to try and mix one more well-known story with something a little bit more obscure as well.
Thank you very much. And finally, I am Mark Norman, and I am the creator and host of the Folklore Podcast. I suppose I should say what I cover as well. Just about everything that is anything to do with folklore, either through my own writing or through the interview of many, many expert guests from various fields of folklore from around the world. 5 seasons and 79 episodes in for this one. So what are we going to do this evening? Well, as I said earlier, everybody has come prepared, armed, if you like, with what they believe to be a winning folklore story. We will set one ground rule for the voting for this, which is you may not vote for your own story. Other than that, it's an open field. So I'm going to ask each of you in turn, and we'll go round in the order that we just introduced ourselves, to tell us why you believe you have a particularly fantastic piece of folklore and what it is. And then at the end, we will all unmute ourselves and some kind of chaotic discussion will ensue, by the end of which, hopefully, we will find a winner. So, Paul, from Tales of Whitlaw, what are you bringing to the table this evening?
I'm bringing the tale of Many-Coloured Sam. So a very strange tale. This is probably the weirdest tale I've read or heard about in years. It's from the 1970s, and two children were walking past the golf course near here in Sandown, and they heard a wailing sound. So they followed a path and came down to near where the airport is, and a chap walked out and said, sort of had a microphone in one hand and a box in the other, and started speaking to these children. And, you know, he said, "Hello, I'm All Colours Sam." And he took them into a little shed. And when they got inside the shed, it was bigger on the inside, a bit like a TARDIS, actually, a bit bigger on the inside than the outside. And he didn't have a neck. And he was about 7 foot tall, and he had big spikes out of his head, and his clothes were all multicolored. The whole thing is truly bizarre. And and the dialogue between All Colours Sam and these children is something completely out of this world. Where the reports of the dialogue is somewhat almost broken English. Things are a bit turned around a little bit. So when I found out about this, and I only found out about this about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I actually went down and traced the steps. And sure enough, everything that's described in the story, actually, you can actually trace it down. And the whole thing has just completely fascinated me. I've even reached out and I've actually been able to find the young girl who in 1972 reported it, who is now in her 60s. I've actually tracked her down and I'm meeting up with her in 2 weeks to go and talk about this story, and she still maintains that it's true to this day.
Intriguing.
And that is I Am All Colours Sam.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Paul. That's a good opening contender in my book. Rick from Law and Legend, what would you like to put up against the tale of All Colours Sam?
Well, I'm going to talk about parrots, and a particular story is called The Night of the Parrot. So a little bit of backstory to this. In one of the episodes in the first series, there's called Lady Isabel. There's a slightly odd scene at the end where she sneaks back into her father's house. And to do this, she has to sneak by her talking parrot and convince him not to wake up her father and give the game away. And anyway, this kind of set off a little research into, you know, it's quite a sort of old timey kind of story. So it's like a parrot in England, you know, how common were parrots, what's their place in folklore and that kind of thing. So anyway, in one of our episodes, we talk about this fascinating history that we discovered about the folklore of parrots and the fact that they were believed to be spiritual and mystical creatures, because a lot of ancient sources, sort of from the classical world, talked about parrots that were sort of found in India. And the fact that they were reported as being able to speak with human voice, this kind of got exaggerated over time, and people thought that they could that they were fully intelligent and they could hold a conversation and all of these kind of things. And they were thought to have lived in the Garden of Eden and to have been cast out. And that's for that reason they were called the Bird of Paradise. And if you ever hear about a popinjay in sort of medieval sources as well, that's another word for parrot. But one thing that we didn't discuss in the episode, or didn't go very much into it, is the fact that they were, because of this spiritual association, they were sort of seen as a royal creature. They were often associated with like elites and kings. And there is actually a particularly well-known Arthurian source legend called The Knight of the Parrot. And basically, this is it's an adventure of King Arthur. And, you know, you have all of these adventures of Lancelot and all the different knights who go off to sort of like earn their kind of chivalrous deeds and dues, all in the service of King Arthur. The whole premise of this adventure seems to be it takes place in the space between when he becomes king and you know, before he sort of steps back and becomes the king, you know, around the table. So he goes off and he sort of like earns that kind of he does all of his own sort of heroic deeds and that kind of thing. But anyway, very early on in this adventure, he's presented with a quest. So one of these sort of traveling mysterious otherworldly fey ladies says to him that she will take him to one of the most beautiful courts you could ever hope to see anywhere, which is quite close by here. Some 500 knights may be found there, the best in all the land, who have already gathered to attend court, ordered in such a way that he who claims to have the most beautiful damsel, and can prove this by exercise of arms, shall thereby gain a parrot, which a dwarf brings there every year, it being the best bird in the world, who sings the sweet, pleasant song of love, and converses cleverly about matters which warm the hearts of men and women. So King Arthur goes there, he wins the fight against the baddest and meanest knight in this court, as you would expect him to. And when this happens, he wins the parrot, and he the parrot's quite a comic character. He's sort of like, think of Iago in Aladdin. He's very loquacious, and he spends all of his time talking about how brave and excited he is to be the parrot of the best knight of the world. And obviously this tale is like a lot of Arthurian legends, you know, it's as long as the quest tree for like a modern online multiplayer role-playing game. So needless to say, a lot goes on, but there's quite a few good comic moments. The one that stands out to me is when King Arthur is having a fight with this kind of monstrous knight, and the dwarf gets so scared that he drops the parrot in the middle of the battlefield and flies away, and the parrot becomes very flustered and starts crying out for his life, and King Arthur's all like, oh, I thought you said that I was the best knight in the world and all these kind of things, so why are you so afraid now? The other thing that the parrot does quite a lot, it seems, is act as a King Arthur's wingman. He spends a lot of time convincing all of the beautiful and noble ladies that he meets on the quest that they should really get together. But anyway, sorry, to bring it to a close, after he has won the parrot, King Arthur declares himself, when all of the people ask that, you know, they ask by what name he who had delivered them from their bondage should be spoken of, and the king answers, by the knight of the parrot. So, you know, all of the different Arthurian knights have, you know, the maiden's knight, the knight of the cart, but I hadn't known before, but King Arthur himself, before he was just King Arthur, was the knight of the parrot. So that's my contribution.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Rick. So there we go. The tale of All Coloured Sam, the knight of the parrot, not Hammer Horror's best film from their stable, in my opinion. Holly, please bring some sense to this meeting that is quickly going downhill already.
Okay, so I don't really have a story as such, but I have a theme that I wanted to bring. So the first is, there's a household spirit in Spain called a trasgu, and it's really destructive, will create loads of havoc, loads of noise, destroy your home. But if you want to distract it from doing that, you just make a mess with small seeds and it will want to pick it up. But this is impossible for it because it has a hole in its hand. So it just spends the entire night picking it up until it gets bored and leaves you alone and goes away. And this is linked, well, it's not really linked, but I think most people have heard of Will-o'-the-Wisps, which are sort of like little spirit lights that guide you out into the distance and you get lost as a traveller. And if you want to distract that, you get a needle, place it in the ground, and what the Will-o'-the-Wisp will want to do is then try and fit through the head of the needle. And while it's doing that, you can just wander slowly away. And the final one, which I think is my favourite, is vampires. Because if you want to distract a vampire, you get a load of rice or poppy seeds. You put them by the grave of the person who you think is going to turn into a vampire, or outside your house, or just carry them in your pockets and scatter them. And they will stop and want to count them, and it gives you time to get away until they've counted all of them and they've got the right number. So my submission is basically how easy it is to distract these really fearsome creatures that want to kill you. So I just like the idea of a traveller, say 400 years ago, coming across a Transylvanian village, say, and then go, well, that big castle up there, like, there is a vampire, so do watch out for him. But here's your free rice. We put some out by the castle. I wouldn't worry about it too much. It's fine. So, yeah, that's my submission.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Distraction in folklore. Okay, over to Graham. Tales of the British Isles. What would you like to submit, Graham?
Okay, so I've got not one story, but a kind of collection of stories, but I'm not going to try and tell them all, so that's one good thing for you all. And these are MC Balfour's 10 Legends of the Cars series. they're from the 1880s, and Balfour was a folklorist. She mostly did these stories, with what she's famous for. And they're really quite unique as folk tales go. I should probably say, as a way of introduction, what the Carrs are. This isn't Carrs, obviously. The Carrs are an area of fenland in Lincolnshire. They're all very flat and marshy, cut through with drainage ditches to try and reclaim some of the land. Now, by the time that Balfour was collecting these stories, that had happened. But she's harking back to this time before that, and she presents this place as the strangest, remotest area of the country before the drainage. And I'm just going to quote here. "The Carrs, as they once were, a wild, desolate, dreary marsh full of strange sights and sounds. Here in this bleak and lonely tract, scarcely yet won over to civilization, has dwelt for ages a people, ignorant, poverty-stricken, and strongly affected by their wild home. And still here amongst a few elders who remember the traditions of their youth linger tales that tell of the old pagan customs that have perhaps existed in these parts since the very dawn of history." Now, that's just her introduction to the place. That's not a story. That's what she thinks of this place, apparently. And I know that's probably just how a lot of Southerners see the North, but it's not typical in people collecting folk tales and how they represent them. This is about 50 miles away from a decent-sized modern city. But no, this isn't a quaint rural place with some charming traditions. It's a Lovecraftian hellhole. And then when we go into the stories, which are written in this really difficult-to-parse transcription of the local dialect, which she basically invents this, and it's all full of apostrophes and commas and incredibly difficult to understand, they don't follow any standard narrative form at all. And there's no guarantee of a happy ending. Taken together, they paint this picture of how horrific it is to live out in this area, where there are just monumental numbers of supernatural terrors roaming the place, like something from Buffy or The Witcher. There's boggarts and witches and giant cats and bogles and will-o'-the-wisps and skeletons and jack-o'-lanterns and crawling horrors and the ever-present animated corpses of the dead. And that's just from one line in one story. And the people who live in these areas are basically relying on these magical powers to keep them safe. They have wise women and magic charms, and they smear blood on entranceways, and they make offerings to the strangers at harvest time. And it's all just really folk horror, and that is not something you get very often in folk tales. And they're just a kind of joy to read these unexpected stories. So I've told one on the podcast already, which is The Dead Moon. And that has a kind of happy ending, but that is not common. Most of them are this unremittingly bleakness, and some of them are told by children. She collected them from children, and I think that might be one reason why. There's one about a man who goes into the swamp, who thinks he's better than all the marsh creatures, and you just know he's going to get it. And in this really intense scene, he gets dragged into the swamp by a disembodied hand. Okay, fine. But they find him later. And then the rest of the tale is, they find him. His own hand has been ripped off by the stump, and he's unable to speak. And then he just hangs around for a year, dies. His mum, she dies too out of heartbreak, because, yeah, why not? That's it, really. That's the kind of thing that happens in the swamp. Best not live here. There's a similar tale with another Tom who does a good turn for a creature called Yallery Brown, and he ends up cursed with ill luck for life. That's the story. It's not a good place to live. Now, there's a bit of a difference in quality in some of these, so while some of them hold together, there's others that are this really just like a monologue, or like a monologue-y macabre stream of consciousness. And my favourite for that is one called Flying Childer, and that's the last one I'll try to kind of summarise here, though I really would encourage you to go and read these, but probably not in the original. And in Flying Childer, there's some of the elements kind of featured in this include a murder. Well, the first murder. That murder victim having their hands and feet hacked off and thrown into a pig pen, where they then call out to be properly buried. I'm not sure what they're calling out with, but call out they do. There's a wise woman, because there's always a wise woman. Then there's another murder of a mother by another kidnapper, but he then gets killed by his flying children. They're flying, because why not? But it doesn't end there. Oh no. No, then he wakes up in some kind of strange limbo afterlife that's never really explained, where a giant worm with the head of the murdered woman eats him up all slowly. And it's just like being in a bad trip, and you kind of read these stories and just think, wow, folklore's really weird, isn't it? And I tell these particularly because it was when I think I knew one of these as a child, and a couple of years ago, I picked up a book of these and started to read them, and then I thought, wow, this is interesting. And that's what really got me back into folk stories and telling them on the podcast. And that's my submission.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Graham. So in an effort to win, Graham crams every sort of folkloric creature and tale that you can imagine there into one submission. Good work.
That was cheating, wasn't it?
We'll let you off. David, Tales from Rat City. Are you going to hit us with some Australian folklore?
I was thinking I should just get a bit of diversity in there. And I'm going to tell the story of the Harton Hills ghost. And this is something I want to write a paper on or something about one day, because I think it's a fascinating story with a lot of layers to it. So in Australia, like in the UK, you had this phenomena in the mid to late 19th century of people playing the ghost, going out in ghost costumes and scaring people, you know, tied into Spring Hill Jack. In fact, we had our own Spring Hill Jack panics. Now, this is a particularly odd one. Harton Hills is a small town based around a cattle station, former squatter settlement between Portland and Hamilton in Western Victoria, a fairly remote place. In 1877, people became absolutely stricken with terror at the Harton Hills ghost. And this was the ghost that took the form of a dead Gunji Mara man, that is the indigenous population of Western Victoria in around that Portland region, on sites where there'd been conflict between the settlers and the indigenous people. Indeed, at one particular place at Blackfellas Creek, they described it as where the white fellas and black fellas had an altercation and the black fellas ended up worse off. And this was tied to a pattern of quite deliberate and systemic genocide by the early squatters when they came to Western Victoria trying to remove the Gunji Mara people from the land to appropriate it for sheep and cattle farming. And it turned quite bloody. It's referred to in Australian history as the Umarella Wars. Though, of course, there's political debates where they go, was it really a war or not because of numbers of people and a sort of a general pattern of demeaning Indigenous resistance. So this particular story is these people became struck with terror. They were seeing this figure on these sites, covered in phosphorescent paint in the matter of the war paint of the Gunji Mara people, appearing at these different sites. And people became absolutely terrified. And the papers started to refer to it as, is this an example of Namadige? And Namadige was the term the Indigenous people used in Victoria to describe a mythology that when Indigenous people died, they were reborn as white people and vice versa. And part of this was in settlement in Victoria, the ships came from the south, which is where the souls were meant to go when they passed on. They were white, and the burial rituals of the Indigenous people involved smoking the bodies and preparing them with clay so they would turn white, and white is the colour of the paints they would use when they're in funeral rituals. And this goes back a long, long time, to try to run a full time to talk about it. But you get interesting stories like, you know, when black fella Kalpami jump up white fella. You get interesting stories from this where, you know, one of the first people executed in Victoria was an Indigenous man, and he said, you know, no matter, me jump up white fella with plenty of sixpence, you'll see. But they also had this belief then that the reason white people acted so horridly was the trauma of dying erased their memory, that they blotted it out because of that experience of going to the netherworld. So that's why they didn't know how to behave, they didn't know kinship, they didn't know how to relate to the land. So we have this ghost popping up, and it terrified people. They sent out huge posses of dozens and dozens of boundary riders with local townsfolk out heavily armed across the countryside. And eventually they capture this man, a woodcutter by the name of Robert Downey, and they beat the tar out of him. And he says, no, I was just doing it for a lark. Never mind, you know, it was just a silly joke. What the hell? Yet the odd thing is he knew the sites. He knew the locations. He took the time to dress as a Gunji Mara man. And we know nothing about him. Just there's this woodcutter who was reenacting being a ghost on sites of horrific trauma that people pretended that no one had knew about, that no one knew about the massacres of Indigenous people at these places. Yet here he was reenacting it as a ghost. and that being on those sites was such that it terrified people to the point where they dropped everything and went out in huge armed posses to capture the Harton Hills ghost. And I think there's a lot of very interesting layers there. There's a lot of very interesting local politics. There's a lot of interesting discussion of, you know, who these people were, what was their relationship to those conflicts of the Umarela Wars in the 1840s and early 1850s. And that's my contribution.
Thank you very much, David. Icy, I know, is going to come straight back at you with something that you've already mentioned in your contribution. Icy, tell us why you think you have the most fabulous folklore.
Well, because I've got Spring Heeler Jack. I'm not going to drop my mic, although pretty much I could at this point. I think Spring Heeler Jack is, well, he's a funny one because he's actually a bit of a wrong'un, but he's developed in a reputation as being a bit of an anti-hero, and he's made a leap, pardon the pun, totally unintentional, into popular culture in a way that I think has sort of aligned him with sort of superheroes and so on. And basically who he is back in 1838, there was a report in the Times of an attack in Peckham, and it was swiftly followed a couple of days later by attacks in Hammersmith. And bearing in mind, these are obviously villages on the edge of London at the time, not what they are now. And it was essentially this figure. The reports do vary what it looked like, and it was sort of, you know, attacking women in particular. And it all sort of took the papers by storm for the first couple of months of 1838, and then it all kind of came to a head in February of that year, because there'd been so many attacks on people, and I think it was because the guy had these big claws, and he was obviously ripping at people's clothes and things. And there was a reward put out for his capture, because obviously he's upsetting the populace. And a woman called Jane Allsop opened the door because someone was knocking. So, you know, that's what you do. And this guy came to the door pretending that he'd caught Spring Heeler Jack, but he needed a candle so he could, like, check. So Jane turns away, and then he basically jumps on her. And according to her statement, he actually vomited blue flames on her. And that's the kind of thing that would stick in your mind. And he started obviously clawing at her and tearing her clothes and everything. And it was actually her father and sister that came to her rescue. And because of the testimony of them and her injuries, it corroborated her story. And the funny thing is, you can actually obviously read these stories in the paper. And it's weird thinking how they went from these stories of just somebody being attacked at the door to what he became later. And the last sort of true report of him, by some people's reckoning, is actually 8 days later by a girl called Lucy Scales. And then after that, it just takes off, and you get stories about him from the 1840s, from the southern counties of England and also the eastern counties of England. And Alder shot in 1877, a sentry claimed to have shot him, but it had no effect. And there's a story from 1904 from Liverpool, and obviously you don't have to be a math genius to think 1838 to 1904, that's a fair stretch of time. But where he's quite interesting for me is the way that in the 1863 he appears in Penny Dreadfuls. So he kind of goes from, I called him a demented gummy bear in my podcast, and that's honestly been the most tweeted thing I think I've ever said. And he appears in these stories where he's then going around, and he's acting like an anti-hero running rings around the police, and his alter ego is called the Marquess, because he was believed to be the Marquess of Waterford. And he allegedly wears a skin tight costume, he's got a cloak in some of the stories, he's got these big claws, he's got a helmet. And he apparently, the thing that really makes him stand out is the fact he can leap like 10 to 15 feet at a time. And where he's interesting for me, and this is why I think he's cool, is because all of the stuff that people repeat as fact is actually probably nonsense, because it all comes from the Penny Dreadfuls. So he's an example of a figure where something genuinely weird happened, and some guy was genuinely running around and just randomly attacking people for whatever reason we'll never know. And then all of a sudden he then becomes an anti-hero. And yeah, I mean, he was getting set up to be the villain in the second series of Houdini and Doyle that never got made. And somebody wrote a letter to the police claiming he was Jack the Ripper, which again, the maths doesn't work. And I just love the way that he then also pops up in other countries as well. And I think part of it is because of the fact the authorities couldn't catch him. There's like that little part of all of us who's kind of like, yeah, you go, you're a rotten person, but you can get one over on them. And I don't think there's been any stories of him for a while, but it is 2020. So who knows? This could be the year that he makes his comeback. That's my submission.
Thank you very much. I see the family fun of folklore that is slashing innocent Victorian ladies in the street. Perfect. Okay, so in an effort to beat all of you and take this crown, Lawmen obviously are going to gang up and have two separate submissions rather than one between them to give them a 50% extra chance of winning. So James, you're first up. You can't have the ghost duck, unfortunately. That's already been mentioned. What are you going to bring to the table?
What? Oh. Well, what I've got a ghost story for you. This one is from one of my favourite books, The Folklore of the Cotswolds by Catherine M. Briggs. It is such a good book. I had first heard of this story when I first moved to the Cotswolds when I was about 8 or 9, and something about it really stuck with me. So I lived in Chipping Norton, which is a little town, little market town in the Cotswolds. And this story happened at the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. A man, a brewer called Mr. Bayliss, who I'm going to refer to as Popper Bayliss because he's the father of the person who he told it to. Popper Bayliss, he was dating a girl in Milton-under-Wychwood, which is a little town not too far away. And he would go to visit her on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And he would walk back at night. And Wednesdays he'd get home in good time, but on Saturdays he'd stay a little bit later. And a couple of times on his walk, he'd notice a weird sound of like some sort of ghostly, like a ghostly horse and cart shooting by, a coach shooting by, and that kind of freaked him out a little bit. And then, but one Saturday, a very dark Saturday, he was comforted by the sound of someone walking behind him, and he struck up a conversation with them and didn't seem to notice that week that the person didn't say anything and just turned off and carried on to Churchill. And then the next week he was walking again, and around the same point he heard the footsteps behind him and again didn't seem to realise that he was just chatting away to the guy and the guy wasn't chatting back to him. And then the third week it was a full moon and he thought, I'm going to have a look at this guy. So he turned around and looked, and the guy behind him was your textbook ghost. He was an Elizabethan dressed man with absolutely no head at all on his head. It was underneath his arm, and Popper Bayliss ran and hid and always made sure that he was home before midnight. And that's the tale of Popper Bayliss.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, James. We'll split the lawmen up, I think. Let's have Daniel from House of Legends in between. Bring your story to the table, Daniel.
Okay. Well, I've had like 100 different stories go through my head by now because everyone's talked about such interesting things and it's made me go like, oh, I want to talk about this now. Oh, I want to talk about this now. But now I've gone all ghosty. So I'm going to talk about Bloody Mackenzie. So Bloody Mackenzie is Edinburgh's poltergeist. And take it back when he was alive. He oversaw the Covenanters' prison. He was Sir George Mackenzie. And it was his job to deal with the people, the prisoners and the last survivors of the Covenanter rebellion in the 17th century. So he oversaw the Covenanters' prison, which was at the end of Greyfriars Kirkyard, home to Greyfriars Bobby, which some of you might know, slightly nicer story. So he oversaw these people and he was dealing with their food and their provisions. He was dealing with their trials and their executions. And when this was all over, when he died, they gave the city council Suffolk to give him a crypt, the nicest one in the whole of Edinburgh, possibly the nicest one in the whole of Scotland. And they put it right next to the Covenanter's prison. And the story goes quiet for a couple of hundred years until 1999, when during a winter storm, a homeless man came into Greyfriars Kirkyard looking for a place to take shelter. And this is supposedly a fact. He went into George Mackenzie's crypt. He saw stairs leading down. He went down there and he saw four coffins on stone plinths. And he did what any of us would surely do in that situation. He started cracking open the coffins and looting the bodies. So he's taking, yeah, I can see everyone's nodding. So he was taking rings and necklaces, what have you. And he did the first coffin, and he did the second coffin, he did the third coffin. And he was just coming to Mackenzie's coffin when the ground gave way beneath him. And he fell down, down into a lower chamber. He fell into a plague pit, a pit that had been sealed for hundreds of years, full of plague corpses. And apparently it had been so well sealed that they still had a bit of flesh on them, green slime on them, all this stuff. He fell into all this. And, well, he wasn't having a very good time by this stage. He was screaming and screaming, and he climbs out of there, runs out of the crypt and gets away from there. And it's decided after that, he gets seen and people are a bit freaked out by this. It's decided after that they should put a padlock on George Mackenzie's crypt door. So they did that. But the very next day after they did that, a woman is supposedly walking through the graveyard on her lunch break, just an ordinary lady having an ordinary day, went boom, she was hit by, she called it an invisible force that knocked her off her feet, slammed her down on the ground. And they say this meant the bloody Mackenzie was out. And since then, there have been hundreds and hundreds of documented attacks on people in this graveyard believed to be the work of Mackenzie. Over 140 people have been knocked unconscious. And you go online, you can see lots of pictures of cuts and scrapes and bruises and so on. And well, I could go on and on. There's so many stories about Mackenzie, and just to give a couple. One was that a couple of teenage boys broke into his crypt one night, and they went down into the chamber where the coffins are and opened up the coffin and used a penknife to hack off his skull. This was in the paper, these kids, they got caught and they brought it out and they took it out, and this was late at night, you know, they've been drinking a bit as you do in the graveyard, and they started tossing it back and forth. They started playing football with it, kicking it between the gravestones. I'm told that they turned it upside down, filled it with beer, maybe Buckfast, and drank from it, which is just pretty disgusting. They were seen there, caught up with, because they're under 18, their names aren't known. But another story is that a year after this all started, a guy called Colin Grant, a spiritualist minister, called up the people around the graveyard and said, oh, I'd like to help out. I'm hearing about this bloody Mackenzie, and I'm a bit of an exorcist. I'd like to try and help this guy move on to the next world. Can I come and do that? And they said, yeah, if you want, you're a free country. So he came along and he went and stood before Mackenzie's tomb. And he went into his trance. And then he went very white and he began to shake, came out of it and ran to the other side of the graveyard. And when he could talk, the guys were saying, well, what happened? And he said he went into his trance and found himself surrounded by this great throng of spirits. And this was a guy, this was his bread and butter. This was just a Tuesday for him. But there were so many of them and they were in such a terrible state and they're all screaming and screaming. And he said, I can't come back here. And he left. And this was in 2000, two weeks after that day, Colin Grant, this minister, he dropped dead of a heart attack, believed to be the work of bloody Mackenzie. And just to finish off, there is a story, I don't know if this one's true, but apparently a couple of stonemasons were working down in the tomb and they heard moaning. And these guys were freaked out, you know, they were big tough guys, but they heard this moaning, so they were freaked out and they came out and said to the gaffer, no, I'm not going back down there. And he's like, oh, I'll come down. So he went down into the crypt with them. And what did he hear? But, And he got to this He saw it was coming through this little wall there, and he started chipping away. And made a little hole in the wall, and they found the source of the moaning. Apparently, they'd chipped through to the basement flats on the other side of the wall to a bedroom where a man and lady were having a special cuddle, and that was the source of the moaning. Don't know if that last one's true. I just heard it, but I like it. So that's a bit of folklore about Edinburgh's poltergeist, Bloody Mackenzie. If you ever come by to Edinburgh, you can go and knock on his door and see if he comes out, but you probably shouldn't because he probably will.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Daniel. And a good shout out there for Buckfast Tonic Wine. I live not too far from Buckfast Abbey, so it's good to hear that one come up again. Alistair, back to the lawmen. What would you like to offer for the other half of your podcast submission?
First of all, I really appreciated the story there, Daniel, where you said they were drinking beer or Buckfast out of a man's skull, but they were 16, which is not appropriate. You shouldn't be drinking alcohol out of a skull at that age. That is illegal, actually. So thank you for pointing that out. I really enjoyed that. It is unfair. We're cheating because there's two of us. So I thought I wouldn't give you a story per se. I would give you a legend that definitely won't win, but I think represents the spirit of everything that is important in capturing folklore. My legend is a woman called Patricia I'm going to say her name correctly to show the appropriate respect. Patricia Wilnecker. And we've probably done about 60 stories, and she stayed with me longer than anyone else because she's a collector of ghost stories, mostly, and she's published a few, I won't call them books, I think pamphlets is the technical word, based around Poole in Dorset. In Dorset? Of course I would. I bloody love the place. That call and response usually works better when James's mic isn't muted, but it's very, very funny, and we do it every time. So I hope you enjoyed it. And she is an enthusiast. I wouldn't say she is the greatest writer, nor has she got the best nose for a tale, because her stories, I think they're all true, but it's all things like, I woke up in the night, and when I went into the hall, the chair was wet. And that's the whole story. And then that's just the next one. It's like, I thought I saw someone, but when I checked, there was no one there. And every one of them is like that. But they're written 50% in all caps in order to add drama. Half of it is about her dog Bounty, which I find adorable. And in reporting on her stories, because she sounds like, from the way she writes, she's somewhat aged. No, that was a terrible word. I was trying to find a nice word. She sounds like an old woman. I wanted to know whether she was still with us, and so I Googled her, thinking I might find an obituary, which hopefully I won't, and I haven't. But there is a Daily Mail article about her, which has brought me more delight than anything it printed in the Daily Mail has any right to. The headline is, Pensioner 81, who visited the same beauty spot for 70 years, is banned from ever returning after the landowner accused her of mowing down his son with her car. Yes, this is the work of Patricia Wilnecker. She's visited Lamorna Cove every year since 1948, until she, and I'm going to make this very clear, allegedly knocked down the owner's son, who is 36 years old, so let's not feel too sorry for him. May not even have happened. My favourite thing about this story is, she absolutely loves this place. She's been banned from ever returning unless she apologises for knocking down the guy's son with a car, and that is not happening. I think Patricia Wilnecker is a genuine legend.
Fantastic. I would be inclined to agree with you. Thank you very much, Alistair. Al from Bone and Sickle, which one of your distinctly unpleasant tales are you going to pull out of the bag for this meeting?
As an American, I don't feel obliged to adhere to any of the rules we're all using. I have a sort of a category, and not a one tale, but a category. When I did a recent episode on superstitions associated with toads, I was surprised there was so much material there, and so much material I had never encountered before. Somebody's sort of obsessed with this sort of thing. Rick did it a bit with his parrots, I think. We had the Lady Isabel in a show too, and I wanted to go down other paths with the parrots, but the toad episode gave me an excuse to do this. I already knew about the toads in Macbeth. Agnes Sampson had a toad as a familiar, so I knew about witches' familiars as toads, but I hadn't realized what an important thing it was for the witches in Spain, in the Basque regions in the Pyrenees. There's a, by the way, since I do, I'm not telling a tale, Mark, I'm just gonna use this time, you gave it to me. So I'm gonna throw out a movie some people might enjoy. It's called Zugarramurdi in Spanish, but the English title is Witchin' and Bitchin'. That's the American title, at least. And it's about the witches. There was in the Basque regions that was actually more than any other region in Spain. So apparently toads were extremely important in this area. And what particularly figured into all of the Sabbaths and other rituals was toad water. Toad water was something that toads would be dried, and then they would be ground up, and then they'd be boiled in water, and this would be used for baptism. But also that was just like the beginning of how toads were used. They were also used as sort of music makers. There's one account that has toads dressed in little velvet suits and shaken as a sort of percussion instrument during the Sabbath. There's also accounts of toads being fed by the witches that were kind of they hadn't yet graduated to taking part in the Sabbath, so they were toad babysitters during the Sabbath. So that was another aspect of their toad fixation. Apparently they also played bagpipes at the Sabbath, which is Sabbaths. Some of you guys will know the Charles McKay, I think. Charles McKay's Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. He has a chapter in there about the witch mania, and I don't know where what his source is, but he does mention, let's see, standing on their toads standing on their hind legs while the devil played the bagpipes or the trumpet. The toads were all endowed with the faculty of speech, entreated the witches to reward them with the flesh of unbaptized babes for the exertions that had given them pleasure, and the witches promised compliance. The devil then bade them keep their word, and then stamped his foot, and the toads sink into the earth. So that's the end of the witches, the toads in Spain. I was surprised that they were a big part of in Finland. I ran into them again in the phenomena of toad coffins. Apparently these are kind of like witch bottles that would be stashed usually in old churches, and a bunch of 19th century renovations found these little coffins. The toad has to be a red toad, according to the instructions. The coffin has to be made out of wood from all the pieces have to be from one tree, 8 nails, 9 through the heart, and that has to be tied with red thread, and so they would function. People would plant them in there for basically it was counter magic to attack people they thought had attacked them via witchcraft. I had not known about toad fairs, which I guess, Mark, might have been in your region. I'm not sure. Big thing in the 1800s. So I'm finding all these things out when I'm researching toads. And also the toad men, another thing I hadn't known about. It's a horseman's cult. It was like the horseman's word, the horse whisper phenomena. But this would involve people who wanted to train horses would have to find a toad, kill it, hang it in a bramble bush, and then once it had decayed, they could take the bones, throw them in a stream, and the bones would be found, and that would, if they carried the bone that surfaced, that would give them control over horses. So another thing I had not known, toadstones. I had not known about toadstones. I'm just making all of these discoveries along the way. The toadstone is a stone that's good against poisons in the Middle Ages. It was in the center of the toad's head. It was removed by placing the toad on a red cloth, and you'd have to, according to one book from the 1600s I saw, you have to place the toad on the red cloth, cut a hole in the cloth, put a box underneath, and then you can obtain the stone. But it's a Flemish scientist who was a father of mineralogy, or tried that experiment as a young man, and he spent all night and was grievously disappointed in that. The best story, I will end with an actual little bit of a story, involves the Saint William of Norwich, or Norwich, as I as an American would say, but I've been roundly scolded, and I'm learning a lot. He involves not even him, but it involves a devotee of his, a woman named Wimmerk. I don't think there's any other stories about her, but it involves her being in prison for being a Christian. And the toads were considered very poisonous in the Middle Ages, so there were lots of toads populating the dungeon she was thrown into. And she and the other inmates of the dungeon decided that might be good to escape by poisoning the guard. So they grabbed the toads and extracted the venom and offered the guard the venom to drink, which for some reason he refused. I don't know. And he had a better idea. He said, why don't you drink this concoction? And apparently so they were all forced to drink the concoction. They all swelled up, according to the stories, till I think the quote is, till no one believed they could swell anymore. And we only follow one of the people in the story, which is the woman Wimmerk. We don't know anything about her except she was a Christian woman. And according to the account I have, she went to the shrine of St. Norwich, William of Norwich, and she found there that found a shrine and bowed before him. And then the moment she bowed before him, she was greatly swollen, but the swelling was released, and she vomited so that, as it says in the text that I have, is she the largest vessels possible had to be obtained to fill. So this happened, and then she was told, and then everyone was evacuated according to this account. And it was an ugly scene, but apparently after that she was healed of her swelling, her great swelling. So I just found all of this very inspiring. I had not known a lot of this about toads, and so to find it all in one tiny creature was really a special moment for me.
Thank you very much, Al. I can always rely on you for something more savoury. I know I can't imagine who messaged you on Twitter to correct your pronunciation of Norwich. It's disgraceful behaviour. Sian, over to you for your description of the thing that you would like to present with absolutely no tangents at all.
That's going to be difficult. But I'm going to try it. Okay, so I'm going to put forth the Mabinogion. So it might not count as a bit of folklore, as it's, you know, a piece of medieval literature, but as it's based on myths and legends, we're going to go for it, but only the fourth branch. So basically, it starts off with Math Mafonwy, who's a wizard, and the only way he can stay alive is that he needs to put his feet on a virgin's lap. I mean, fair enough. I feel like most people have to do that, to be honest, except in times of war. So his two nephews, Gilveithui and Gwydion, are both really into Gawain, the virgin, who's, you know, got feet in her lap all the time. They actually force themselves on her, not very nice. So when Math finds out, he turns them into loads of different beasts and, you know, animals, and they mate with each other and produce children. And he does this three times, which is you know, a little bit disgusting, but also kind of absolutely brilliant, which is another thing why I love the Mabinogion so much, is that it's purely magical realism. So some of it is played as so straight and completely normal, but all this wild stuff is happening. Absolutely love it. Anyway, so finally he forgives Gwydion, and he basically asks him, well, you need to find me a new virgin now, because, you know, I've married mine, I've had to make her my queen. So they approach Maff's daughter or niece, and they basically say, oh, you can be the new virgin. And actually, it turns out she's had two magical children, so she can't do that. Gwydion finds one of her magical children and then tries to trick Aranharod to, like, you know, claim him. And she says, well, no, I won't claim him, and I won't name him, I won't arm him, and he'll never have a wife. So they do all these different strange tricks and everything to trick her into actually making sure that he has a wife. And in the end, Gwydion actually, who's also a wizard, by the way, magics up a lovely flower maiden for a magical son who is called Clu-Claw Giffes, so he does get a name in the end. But my absolute favourite part of this is that the poor flower maiden, who has no choice in her husband, by the way, she's just sort of forced to marry whoever, she falls in love with this like other knight called Gronu, who just sort of, I don't know what he's doing really, just riding around the lands. And the only way that you can kill Clu-Claw Giffes is that he has to be on a riverbank in a bathtub with a goat next to the bathtub and his leg on the goat, and then only by a spear, only in a very specific part of his body. But she doesn't know that yet. So I love the way she basically approaches her husband, and she's like, I'm really worried that you're going to die one day. So, you know, just put my worries at ease and tell me exactly how you can be killed. And he's like, oh, you know, sure, I'll tell you exactly in minute detail how you can kill me, a magical being, in only one way. So, of course, he tells her. She gets her boyfriend to kill him. He turns into a mangy, disgusting eagle because he doesn't die. Gwydion runs around the lands of Wales trying to find him, finds this disgusting eagle in a tree, sings at him, and then he turns into a nice hero again. They find Blodey with the flower maiden, turn her into an owl, and then Clu-Claw Giffes lives happily ever after. So just your nice, normal little story, really. There you go.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Sian. Fairy Folk Podcast. We've had a lot of unsavoury stories tonight. Your podcast is always so happy and jolly and smiley sounding. You're going to give us something nicer, surely, aren't you?
I'll try my best. So I'm sure the majority of you will have heard of the creature that I've decided to talk about today, and that's the Loch Ness Monster. So the Loch Ness Monster is part cryptid, part folkloric creature, and often known as Nessie, which is super cute. So Nessie, I suppose, is commonly thought of as being a plesiosaur, which is a type of underwater dinosaur. And there's been many sightings of Nessie over the years, and the earliest is supposed to date back to 565 AD, when St. Columba came face to face with what I think was, he referred to it as a water beast. But then he managed to quite dramatically convince this creature to stay away, and she did for a long while, until around the 1930s. And this became a sort of the heyday of monster hunting, when sightings of Nessie became more frequent and were reported on by the press. And this is when a lot of the kind of classic photos of the monster appeared, with each photographer claiming to have finally captured the creature. Though a lot of these photographs, I suppose, have now are still a few images that are a little bit more difficult to explain away. And I suppose that's what I find really interesting about the Loch Ness Monster, is not just the creature itself, but also the people that have dedicated their lives to searching for it, utterly convinced that, you know, there's something in this loch, that it exists. Like, bless him, Steve Feltham, who still lives beside the loch looking for the creature to this day. He moved there in the 90s, and yeah, you can still find him there now, which is brilliant. But I have to say, the story that stands out to me most, which some of you might have heard before, is that of the infamous Marmaduke Wetherill, who was a big game hunter turned movie star, who the Daily Mail sent to the loch in 1933 to try and track down the creature. And after just 3 days of monster hunting, he claimed to have found an amazing series of footprints beside the loch that supposedly belonged to a giant creature. And so the Daily Mail was so convinced that, you know, this is it, he's found some tangible evidence that the creature exists, that they actually published the headline, "Monster of Loch Ness is not a legend but a fact," which I think is brilliantly dramatic. And so, yes, unfortunately, the National History Museum soon swooped in to reveal the truth that these footprints were not only faked, but they were probably made by a taxidermy hippo foot attached to like an umbrella stand or an ashtray, which is a little bit embarrassing and a little bit funny, but wasn't so great for Marmaduke Weatherall's reputation. But he managed to get his revenge, as Weatherall and his stepson were actually behind the infamous surgeon's photo, which went on to dupe the press and the public for decades afterwards, and I think to this day is probably the most well-known photo linked to the legend of the Loch Ness Monster. So yes, that's my tale. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. It's a classic tale, and certainly one that deserves a place at the table.